So this is a really special night. We are screening the film Snakehead, which is directed by John Alpert of DCTV, right here by us. And it was also produced by Ying Chan, who's here with us today from all the way from Hong Kong. As well as Peter Kwong, who unfortunately passed away earlier this year, but we're really fortunate and lucky to have his wife here, Tushka. So we're excited that, you know, all of you are here, and that the people who created the film are here. Afterwards, Peter and Yin are going to do a Q&A. I'm sure there are going to be a lot of questions after the movie. The movie is in conjunction with the show that's right next to us over here, called Fold, Gold Adventure Paper Sculptures, and that story of that I'm sure many of you remember from 1993 has a lot of tie-ins with the film tonight in terms of human trafficking. So anyway, enjoy the film. I'm going to let John and Ying, if she wants to, give a more proper introduction to the film or say whatever they want to say. And then we're going to roll the film.
So me and Ying are really old now. Once we're down on the floor, it's hard for us to so we're sort of stuck here. But any chance that I have to come and sit next to Ying, even if it's on the floor, I'm going to do, because she's one of the treasures of this community, and her recording is at the heart of this, along with the soul of Peter Kwong. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
On schemes like this about smuggling human beings into
smuggling human beings is a really heinous offense. It is taking human beings and treating them like cargo.
You left your kid behind in China?
So.
What's her name?
Momo.
Momo.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Mr. Wang, why don't you give a message to your daughter?
I really miss her. I really feel very bad.
We're going snakehead shopping. There's supposed to be a crackdown of snakeheads going on here, but everywhere you turn, you'll find one in 5 minutes.
This will cost you $32,000 to $33,000. $33,000. $15,000 US.
Per worker.
Per worker.
All right. Listen, if you had it to do over again, would you come to America again? You would.
America is still the gold mountain.
Okay. How's that?
Yeah.
Well, just very brief, because people should have questions, right? Let's see. Well, the Golden Adventure landed crashed in 1993. It was the night of July 3rd, early morning. And then I went out to the beach, did the story, and then the next day I went to China and went to the villages to visit their families. And this was done a year later, in 1994. It's done typical John Oliver style, right? Camera verite, right? And we did not plan it. We did not plan. But we just go. None of the interviews were set up. None of them were done by appointment. We just go to the shop, go to this, go to that, right? And then people talk to us. And of course, we use a hidden camera. Where's the hidden camera? Here? Here?
Give away the secrets.
No, but this is technology from what? More than 2 decades ago.
Well, that's like it was the first.
It was the first, right? It's not bad.
Yeah.
And I think for me that's the amazing thing. It just showed that people smuggling is so rampant. There's a whole syndicate, there's criminal gangs, government corruption involved. I didn't know these people. I just went to the building, Lao Wu, Labor Service. We went up, and these people are so frank. They can't wait to do the business. And it just showed that the business is so public and so rampant, and how people suffer. Then they have this dream, come to the United States, make a lot of money, and it's typical, they work in sweatshops. The men may work at takeout restaurants. Many of them are outside the city, and the women work at sweatshops, and many work close into prostitution. It's a big business, and they don't have $25,000 to give, they don't have $35,000 to give. So they borrow. And these people that have mortgaged their future, they may spend 10 years to give the money back. And they have to pay it back because they have their family at home. If you don't pay back, they will be in jeopardy. Of course, now today is very different, but immigration issue is still the same. It has taken another form. We can discuss it.
So that you can understand Ying's role in this, certainly her initial investigative reports were very unique, and the fact that she was doing it for the Daily News, can you imagine the Daily News doing this type of investigative reporting today? They don't. And Ying was sort of part of a last group of journalists in service to the public of New York City who would be very, very brave, go places that nobody else would go. When we were over on Allen Street trying to get into these apartments, it's people who want to let us in the apartment. So knock on the door, open up the door like a little crack, and I noticed Ying immediately has her foot in the door, right? And she's talking to the guy, and as talking, you know, like, so she's got the elbow in the door, and then we're inside. And she did it in a irresistible, persistent, not threatening way, but a way that she couldn't be stopped. And this was a very important factor in us getting into a lot of these places. It was harder to get into the stuff here in New York City than it was in China. In China, the impunity and the way in which everybody was doing business and was involved in this was just astonishing.
In the end, when the guy got out of prison, right away they knew he was out and they wanted the $30,000. How did they find out that he was out so quickly?
Oh, they have a very extensive network. They do have a network. You have their friends. They have to report home. When they call home, families know, and the state has to know. And so it's a very elaborate system of collecting money. And a lot of time, the people would borrow money from their relatives to pay the state. And the situation gets so bad that they were kidnapping at the airport. There's another story. We went out to the JFK. When they landed, and then there was a rival gang that would kidnap these people because they're valuable. If you have the people, you have the people, you hold them hostage and you can collect. So it's very elaborate syndicate system.
Yeah, the documentary said snakeheading can be punishable by death, and yet the government is involved in it as well. Is that just sort of for a show, just on the books, or is that actually ever enforced and actually somebody gets put to death for doing that?
I don't know if people were put to death, but at least that was the regulations. Because a child, in official, China says they're going to stop it. There were elaborate articles in the Chinese papers in mainland China combating this kind of smuggling. Because this makes China look really, really bad. So officially, they do have a policy of stomping this out. And also this official policy of anti-corruption. This is corruption. But how's that enforced? And you cannot have these shiploads of people coming without official endorsement. Because the Golden Dungeon is not just one ship. During that period, around 92, 93, there were dozens of ships coming and unloading people. And this one is so blatant. You know, it came into the harbor and crashed.
There's sort of an interesting appendage to the question that you ask. I think it was obvious to us that there's a double standard. There is the law that's on the books, and there's the complete ignoring of that law, and the participation of the people who were supposed to enforce that law in the profits of the illegal trade. This was probably the last report that I ever made for NBC. I was in the process of being blacklisted, and this was sort of my swan song. And Tom Brokaw was sort of involved in helping get this one last report on the air. It was the beginning of the NBC show Dateline, which is sort of morphed into something really quite bizarre. But that was supposed to be their new news magazine show, and this was supposed to be the lead story in that. So they want Tom to introduce this Tom Brokaw. And they bring down this lighting truck and a crane. In those days, all the anchors were using cranes. And if one anchor, like Dan Rather, had a crane shot of him in a field, Tom wanted to have a crane shot. So Tom had to have a crane shot in Chinatown. And it must have cost them, we were counting, because it took them 3 days to set up, and the whole crew, it cost them about 500 times more to shoot this 10-second introduction than it costs for our whole one-year-long investigative reporting. And then in the end, they decided not to use it because they built a new set, and they decided, well, let's put Tom on the new set. So they just threw this money away, but they needed to involve Tom in the show, and that was sort of our price for getting it on TV. So they tried to find a Chinese official who's dumb enough to show up at NBC. They had questioned about this, and they're all ducking. And finally, like the assistant to the mission of the United Nations shows up for Tom to question him. So Tom says, Mr. Ambassador, What is your policy about this illegal immigration? Are you against this, or are you enforcing your laws? And he says, yes, certainly, you know, it's against the law, and it's death penalty for snakeheads. And Tom goes, well, what about this? And gestures to the TV set, where they're supposed to play this clip. And the crack NBC technicians were sort of sleeping and weren't ready for this, so that it doesn't play, that Tom gets really angry and does the whole thing again. And ask the guy, and the guy says, no, no, we have this law. And Tom goes, what about this? And doesn't play again. He does it three times, okay? So by the time he finally gets it to play, Tom is in such a tizzy that we talked about this. I said, Tom, you're going to get this guy in trouble, and you're going to get the guy in China killed. You can't do this. And what you're going to have to do is that when you're done with this, you're going to have to get the guy to promise that they won't kill the guy, and that you're going to check up on it. Mm-hmm. And Tom, by this time, is so twisted, he goes, "And I demand that you enforce the death penalty on..." And I'm going, "No, no, Tom!" And I have to come running out on the set and stop the taping and say, "Tom, we can't murder people with this. And you got to get the other promise." And so the guy promised that the guy will be okay. And they finally broadcast the report on TV.
Were any of the people smuggled in being sent back to China? If that's the case, what happened to them?
Well, I have to say, in those days, immigration policy here is much more liberal. So that's why you have people willing to appear on camera for us. And I also know that they will not get into trouble here. So then we can film them and all that. I will not do it today, of course. We can't. Okay? Because even in those days, we're talking about the early 90s, if I call up immigration and say, "Hey, please go up," it's illegal for immigrants. They won't bother. Right? And because in those days, the target was what they call criminal aliens. Those who broke the law and really felony offenses. And they were kept in jail for different periods of time, and they were found out around the country because there's not enough jail space for that in New York. The guy we saw here in where we visited, they were held at Ferry Street nearby. And then others were sent to Pennsylvania, but where the local community supported them. And that was the exhibit that we saw, you see outside. I believe found out around the country. So many of them eventually got released into the community without a green card, but they can stay suspension of deportation. Some returned to China voluntarily. I think that's a small number. And then some of the women volunteered to leave, and they went to Ecuador, instead of going back to China. So I did not track them, but the people of the Golden Vision might have the numbers. So and I believe some are settled today here in the United States. Whether they can get citizenship, what is their status, it's questionable. This is a very, very harsh climate today, as we would know.
So I wonder, why don't you go to China by yourself? Because you can speak both Chinese and English, and you got the video camera as well. Like, why did you bring the English speaking?
It's a cameraman.
Yeah, I mean, like, is there, like, apart from the translation for the film, is there any like pressure you wanna like bring to the film? And, like, American people always also involved in this issue, are you saying anything to do with, like, to make you decide? Because, like, if you go to China to do filming, like, sometimes maybe, like, people will think, like, so we are not speaking the same language, maybe there's, like, a distance create for the people if you are...
No, I have a distance.
No distance?
Like, we beat that. We just want to go after the story. We follow the story. It's a very important story. We want to understand what's going on, and we want to capture it in camera. And we happen to know each other.
So the Chinese...
And just three of us just went without too much planning, right?
So,
And actually it worked out because the white...
The low five.
Yes, he's my boss. In
our masquerade, when we're tricking everybody, you actually bring the low fund with you, who's trying to get the illegal immigrants, and that was our cover. and it worked out really well. But sort of, how do I say this? Me, Yang, and Peter, we've known each other for half a century. And we've grown up here in this neighborhood. We've been living within 10 blocks of here for a long, long time. And along with Corky, who was from that whole time, we've been involved in a lot of neighborhood activities. I think it was an extension of that. I started out showing my films on a street corner here from an old mail truck. This was before there was cable TV, before there was the internet. It was the only way that we could get our programs in front of people. But I was really terrible when I started, but I got better. And I got better enough so that I was a regular contributor on the Today Show. And so this was a really interesting opportunity for us to report on a story, to go places where nobody was going, but to get it seen by everybody. And so we're sort of like the Three Musketeers, and we always stuck together.
I got a question for Kathy. Like, you know, if we make a film today, and, you know, we need to get copyright and all the permission and all that, would you say that you have to follow those rules, or you got to break them first? You know, go with the undercover camera, go with the, you know, with the check the dive, you know, get it going, get it dive going. I mean, that's really what it's all about, I think. Like, play along with your subjects, and you're, you know, having a lot of empathy for them, because you're really trying to, I think, undermine the whole system and helping ultimately those individuals that are underdogs.
Oh, we didn't exactly break the rules.
We broke lots of laws.
Yeah.
We broke so many laws. And I actually
why the film is so good.
I use some of these clips to illustrate the sort of ethical conundrums that we face and the sort of moral calculus that's getting jiggered all the time. You have to make these decisions on a split-second basis, but we lied about why we're in the country, for sure. And you can go back to China, but I can't because... There's a
cumulative. No, you went back.
I'm saying I can't go now because there's accumulation of all this type of reporting that they finally figured out. Wait, this, and so I can't go back. Ying can, and Ying, you know, the some of the fingerprints. My fingerprints are more clearly on this because when this was broadcast in the United States. Had to be embarrassing. Right? Yeah.
And I
was in. But we're breaking a lot of laws. And so it's interesting what gives reporters, and this is, we talk about this especially with young journalists, because it's an important subject, what gives us higher moral authority to say that we know what's right and what's wrong, and the society doesn't? And if the society has made a law that we think we need to break, we break it. And you know, a lot of people suffer the consequences for this type of work. Luckily, in the United States, we don't get killed like this journalist got killed in Malta two days ago. The level of corruption that we were putting our finger into was certainly as serious as what she did. So in America, we can get blacklisted. We can have to drive taxi cabs again instead of being reporters, but they usually don't kill you.
And for the undercover hidden camera recording, girls don't use it lightly, but there's situations you can do it because number one, there's no other way of getting the story. Number two is that the story is of public interest. It's not some paparazzi or some other people's private affairs. And number three is that we would like to be shoppers to save cost and save money.
last film we made in China, about the earthquake in Sichuan,
you went with Peter.
I went with Peter, and nominated for an Academy Award. What was interesting is when the Academy was announcing the nominees, it was being carried live state television in China, and they pulled the plug and went black. And then they let it be known to HBO that they didn't like this. And at that particular point, which was interesting, if you talk about consequences, HBO stopped backing the film. They were frightened of the consequences for their commerce in China. And instead of campaigning for the film, they were fighting against it, which was like really fascinating and made us really angry. So we leaked the story to the New York Times. So, you know, we're always doing what we can to try and be better reporters, but a lot of times it does involve breaking the law.
You have a question?
My question is, do you think you would have gotten the same openness if you didn't go back with Aloha, if you had gone back with just Peter and another Chinese person?
The story would be different. If I just go by myself, I did go by myself the year before. That's why I kind of know the terrain. People were fairly open. You can see all the characters, like the taxi driver, the woman. There's no appointment. Somehow, you know, we took a cab, met her, we chatted, and then she invited us home to have this fabulous lunch.
But as soon as they saw him. And knew that you guys were American tourists, they didn't give her the cop didn't give her a ticket.
Well,
just let her go.
But we also were pushing too. We let the cop know. I mean, he would have, if Ying and I didn't start chirping up, she would have got the ticket. Mm-hmm. So we're improvising every step of the way. And we're a very effective team because we've been working together and we sort of know how to play one person off against another as part of this big elaborate show in order to get people to be friends. And we're nice people, you know, and people feel this. And when they look at you, I mean, we all, as New Yorkers, have survival skills. Yeah. And, I mean, I look at Corky, and I know lots of things about Corky just by looking at his eyes. And he knows lots of things about me. And you go, and make these judgments based on that. And people can feel what type of person you are. And they have to make a decision whether they're going to trust you, whether they're going to be your friend. And since we believe that most people are good at heart, we're making these connections because these people feel the same way. And they want, hey, whoa, look at this. Look at Ying. She's really here. Let's bring her home. And that's the way it works.
But the other part is also about not taking anything for granted. Don't assume that people will not talk to you. Don't assume that it's difficult. And then we always go to the last extra mile. Like the clip we got, the part on the basement, it was all by accident. We didn't have an appointment with the cops. Because that night, right,
we
were going around, you know, we were going around Chinatown and trying to get some footage. So we were looking for a story. Just, we found nothing. And then we said, oh, let's go home, right? Then we hear the fire trucks. Let's go over to see what's going on. And then it turned out there's this big basement. And then the cops need an interpreter. You know, they ask here, do you speak Cantonese? Oh, all right. So you improvise, you just, that's why... You know, being a reporter, you know, makes you kind of smart. It's training. You have to.
And so, you can tell them what you've done since you've been here in New York and what you've been responsible for. You know, you join in and study the training
program. Oh, that's a long time.
Yeah, but they don't. That's
a tough one. No, I quit the Daily News in 97. Yeah. I was at the Daily News at that time, 94, yeah. I worked for Chinatown papers a long time, and then 1990, I went to the Daily News, and I gave them credit for hiring me because I never worked in any newspaper before. That was my first job. And my first job, I got sent to China to do the, just to cover of people smuggling. And that was in 1990. So I came back, did a story, we went through a lot, there was a strike, and we were out on strike for 5 months. And then I went back and I got a letter work as a greater immigration beat. And then 1993, the ship grounded. I followed that. 94, I went to China to do this film. So in that, we're not only friends with Peter. I mean, we're a cameraman, expert filmmaker. We're Peter, who's an expert in Chinatown history, immigration, and in China. So we our skills kind of complement each other and work with each other well. He's a scholar reporter. I am the street reporter. And they're always crazy people, and just because we love stories, right? We didn't give a second thought about would it be dangerous, what will happen. But it's a judgment call. We think that we'll be fine, that we go through the story. And then just three of us, and we went and brought back the footages.
Did the Times Syndicate know that you guys live in Chinatown, and did they confront you after the story?
They know that. Yeah.
They know you. They could certainly find us very easily, but I never had. I've had repercussions on a lot of stories, but not on this. And to some degree, my low fundness is a little bit of protection.
But before this, since I was covering immigration. I got death threats. I got a contract put on me. Somebody called me up, a friend who's within the circle, and said, "There's a $30,000 contract on you." And in those days, and they said a lot of these kids are very eager to do the job because they need money. In those days, it's also transition. The Yangs were flying dragons and ghost shadows, right? Koki knows what.
White Eagles.
White Eagles. Those established gangs. And they have rules of the street. But then in those days, because you have more younger Fujianese young people coming in, so they became known as Fujian young gangs. They are the upstarters. They're more
crazy.
Yeah, crazy. So, but it comes with the territory. So, do your work. Right.
Were you pushing for a policy change in New York City or in the United States? And was the news pushing for a policy change? Was it different than yours? And what has changed between then and now?
96 to now?
What has changed between when the movie came out and currently? And do you think that?
The change was tremendous, especially now under the Trump administration. It just much, much harsher policy, trust me. Of course, the people smuggling scene changed a lot because China has this sort of kind of reversal of fortunes. They are still the good poor in China who want to go to migrate and go to other places. But China has become much richer, right? So you can make a living over there. There's more opportunities over there. Actually, many of them regret coming here. Just think about it. For 10 years, 15 years, you're separated from your wife and your child. You work in sweatshops, labor conditions, to save money, to pay off your debt. It's very sad. It's really very sad. I mean, these people are people who have mortgage their future. So. You live in Chinatown. I don't.
Gorgeous.
I'm talking. Yeah, he knows.
You guys ever come across Sister Ting?
Oh, yeah, yeah. She died.
Yeah.
Was that another story?
And she died in
jail.
In jail, really?
In jail in China.
So do they know who Sister Peng is? And the sort of significance of that? And the way in which everything was sort of like located on her shoulders and the mythology?
But Kokyu can talk about the immigration situation here. Margaret left. And now the issue, I think, this issue of immigration law, also working conditions, gentrification, evictions. China seems to be disappearing. I went to Hong Kong in 98 to teach at the university at the Great Journalism Program. So I'm kind of not so much in touch, of course, by all what's going on. Silver Palace. And do people know what's Silver Palace? Yeah. Maybe younger people won't know, right? Now it becomes a hotel, charging $400 a night. Right? And then the factories, the garment factories, these used to be on Lafayette, Center Street, and now galleries, luxury lofts.
Yeah.
Where do people live? Where do people live?
Sunset Park.
Sunset Park. Right. So, it's not easy, it's very difficult. And then you have these condos going up, high-rise condo up. I went across Brooklyn Bridge, right? There was this huge condo going up.
XL Tower.
Is that right?
Yeah, the old Pathmark supermarket.
And then I was told that you also have a lot of buyers from China.
Yeah.
From mainland China.
So we all met each other in some type of association with DCTV, which is the neighbor of this museum. We're down Lafayette Street here in the old firehouse. And from the very beginning, we've been involved with different community programs, classes for people who want to learn how to make films, equipment for people who want to make films and can't afford it. We have a nice screening area, which we were talking about before. If the museum ever wants to use it, we're very happy to share this with you. We're building a new interactive theater that's going to be very, very high quality, in which people anywhere in the world can watch the events that are happening in the firehouse and can participate. So everybody's welcome to come there. Our doors have been open now for 45 years, and it would be a real pleasure if anybody wanted to come and see what's going on there and to use any of our services. So you're all welcome.
And Peter was one of the founders.
Peter was one of the founding members. I have lots of funny stories about Peter. This involves the massage parlor. I can't tell the story you should. Okay, this is a good way.
And he was in the board, on the board.
Peter was on our board. Peter actually saved us when you talk about gentrification, this like really nasty slumlord was trying to steal the firehouse for his own personal profit. And Peter saved us, and we've always been very, very grateful for that. That's another different story. But we have more material in the massage parlor. And of course, this is very titillating to the American media. They get really excited about this. This was on NBC. CBS got very jealous. And they knew Peter. And so they asked Peter if they could do their own investigative report about the massage parlors, and if Peter would go do the hidden camera work. And Peter said, sure. Well, Peter's a good
professional.
He asked me before if he could do the investigation.
Yes.
So Peter was a really good professor, But he didn't have as much experience using the hidden camera as me, and I had worked with a guy that had developed this hidden camera and practiced a lot, like you practice the piano. So, I mean, I could grip this thing backwards and upside down, and I knew what it was taking a picture of. And so CBS gave Peter, I think, a camera in the bag.
Yeah.
And they put a little hole in the bag.
Yep.
And sent Peter into the massage parlor to get all this footage. And, you know, like every time, like the first time, I mean, I guess you could hear, like, oh, would you like a massage? And Peter, you know, wants to talk about some type of philosophy, but he hung the camera up crooked, and all you could see was, like, a picture of the wastebasket. So they bring this back, and so they send Peter again the next time, and I think he forgot to turn it on this time. And so he was in the massage parlor, came back with nothing. The third time, he got the camera working perfectly, and he had hung it on a peg right in front of the massage table. And just before he was about to do his investigation, she says, "Let me hang your coat." Hung the coat up. So there's an old joke about, like, the bear, the hunter that's in the woods hunting the bear, and misses the bear, and the bear taps him, like, on the shoulder. At the end of the joke is, "Oh, you're not really here for the hunting, are you?" And so we teased Peter endlessly, and we got to the point where we thought he was, like, personally misengineering his back so he could go back to the massage. Many times. And he was very serious and persistent in his investigation. But he eventually got there.
But his sort of bad story was that he didn't really want to have the ultimate massage. And he got some ladies that were very talkative. So he knew he got really good stories, but it wasn't a pick. But then when he went back, it was sort of really weird. Why are you coming back?
It's not
the real thing, right? So he was trying very hard to sort of not get a full massage. But keep talking.
Nothing above the ankles, please.
So we don't know what happened. We saw what was on camera. That's all we know.
But Peter was very brave and never, you know, he's sort of like the Indiana Jones of scholars. And when we went back on some of our other reporting trips, it was pretty darn dangerous. And the last time that I was in China was when Peter and I were jumped by 35 secret police. What's the capital city?
Chengdu.
In Chengdu. Yeah, Chengdu. We knew the cops were after us, and we managed to evade them and decided that we were done reporting and we had enough material to do our report. And we had secretly shipped out all the footage so that even if we got detained, it would be back in New York. And we decided to go buy souvenirs. One of the things that you have to do as a reporter is that you want to continue to ingratiate yourself with your superiors. And so we were buying nice tea and cookies to bring back to NBC. And we were in the parking lot of the supermarket when all of a sudden five guys popped up. And one of them grabbed Peter and started hauling him away. And I didn't know, hey, stop it. And there's the five more guys. And they all took out their guns. And by the time they were all done taking their guns out and pointing them at me and Peter, it was 35 people that had been following us around. And we thought we were so clever. We weren't as clever as we thought. And we had some wonderful adventures for the rest of the day at the police station. So Peter was very brave.
I think that's it.